Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has two causes for submission this morning. In the order of the presentation, they are as follows. American Physicians Insurance Exchange and American Physician Service Group Incorporated versus Ramon Garcia, MD from Bexar County, and David T. Bard, Commissioner of Banking and Insurance of the State of Vermont and or his successor in office, versus Charles R. Myers Insurance Agency and others, also from Bexar County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for the petitioners and respondents to present oral argument. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal. These arguments are being tape recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to the tapes at a later time, you may make application with the clerk of our court to do so. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in American Physicians Exchange versus Garcia.
May it please the court, Mr. Barry Bishop will present argument for petitioners. Mr. Bishop has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. While this case is phrased as an insurance fraud case, I think the first important issue is who is the plaintiff. The nominal plaintiff is Dr. Ramon Garcia, the insured under a malpractice policy. The party at interest is Mr. Cardenas and his family. The patient of Dr. Garcia, who allegedly was injured by Dr. Garcia malpractice. That leads us to the next point. Who is hurt, injured, or damaged? I think a basic premise of tort law, or any kind of law since I've been practicing, is that there must be damage or injury or harm for there to be a lawsuit.
Are you saying that there can never be an assignment of a cause of action?
No,
is
Your
that
Honor,
the logical conclusion?
What I'm saying is that what is assigned, the harm, injury, or damage, has already been paid. I have no problem with the assignment of a cause of action. But here, the cause of action on the part of Mr. Cardenas, the real party of interest, is $2.235 million. The amount of money that's been paid is $2.5 million. And that's prior to trial. So there is no injury. There is no damage. There is no harm. Mr. Cardenas, who is the real party of interest, I think, has already been paid more than the jury in the malpractice case found he was entitled to recover. Dr. Garcia, who assigned his claims against the insurance company, has been held wholly harmless.
That case wasn't tried to a jury, was it? It was tried to a court.
Tried to a court, that's right, Your Honor. But it was an adversary trial. There's no complaint here that there was not a full trial. There's no claim of collusion. There was a trial. So the situation facing the trial court at the time the case went to trial, this case, was there was no harm, injury, or damage. Now, this court has recently come down with the Stewart Title Company case, which held correctly, in my judgment, that a plaintiff can only recover once his damage. Applying that principle here, the plaintiff, Mr. Cardenas, has been damaged in the amount of $2.235 million. The plaintiff, Mr. Cardenas, has been paid $2.5 million. So there was no damage at the time the case went to trial. And there never was any damage. Now, we can, because we have an unusual fact situation, we can apply any principle we want to get to an apportionment of damage. The one satisfaction rule under Stewart Title, the damage is zero. If we apply comparative negligence, as this court has done in different contexts, the jury here found that the negligence during the policy period was 16%. That would leave damages of $357,000 which is 16% of the $2.235 million. $500,000 has been paid, again, zero.
There's been a total of $2.5 million paid.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the damages in the medical malpractice case were 2.3 something. Is that
2.235,
correct?
2.235, Your Honor.
But $500,000 and $2.5 million were paid for an agreement not to have damages exceeding $2 million and for a continuance. Is that true?
It was a partial settlement, Your Honor. I'm told now that plaintiff's lawyers call that a high and low. My client, APIE, paid $500,000 for an agreement that their liability would not exceed $2.5 million, and the $500,000 would go to the plaintiff regardless.
Why should that be counted in the total amount that's been paid, since it was paid at least in part for something else?
Because that was a contract, Your Honor.
But you obtained something more than payment of the judgment by paying that amount of money. You obtained a continuance, for one thing, as I understand the agreement, as well as a limit on liability.
That's correct. And that was the agreement between the parties. Yeah, we paid $500,000 to limit our liability, get a continuance, and get the credit on the liability. The plaintiff, we've got $500,000 in effect, free and clear. And that was the agreement between the parties. So under the Stewart Title Rule, which I think this court fully understands, there are no damages. There were no damages prior to the time the case went to trial. So we have a case where prior to trial, the plaintiff had not been injured. The plaintiff had recovered more than the amount of his injuries.
Did Dr. Garcia suffer damages over and above his liability exposure to Mr. Cardenas and his family?
There was no evidence of that, Your Honor.
And the Court of Appeals uses the word could, and saying that it could have suffered damage to his credit, and I think I saw a reference to his mental anguish as being a defendant in a malpractice lawsuit. Is there any evidence in the record of those kinds of harm or injury?
No, Your Honor, there's not. And what happened here is the plaintiff went to trial under what I would call the Allstate against Kelly theory, that the amount of the excess judgment was a damage. And the record is quite clear that was the plaintiff's damage theory. And I'm not here arguing to this court that there might not be a case where the insurer could suffer damage over and above or beyond the amount of the judgment. But this case was not tried on that theory. In this case, the insurer, Dr. Garcia, seemed to be satisfied to go simply on the theory that he was entitled to assign to the plaintiff the amount of the damages and go forward. There is no evidence, no proof, no argument, and no contention of any mental anguish, loss of credit, or anything else. I would say, as my personal observation, that I think in a Stowers case, there could be those kind of damages. The image comes to my mind that a person suffering a judgment could lose his business, or lose his home, or lose his credit, and therefore suffer damages far beyond the amount of the judgment against him. But that's not this case. In this case, the insured assigned his claim and left.
To your way of thinking, is there anything unique about the nature of the insurer-insured relationship, which this court has called a special relationship and in other cases, that would limit in any way its assignability as a general proposition?
No, I have no problem with the assignability of the policy benefits. It seems to me, and I think this may be my strongest contention, that once the insurer has fully protected himself against an excess judgment, as in this case, where the judgment in the malpractice case, the liability case, or whatever, cannot possibly result in any harm to the insurer. It seems to me that at that point in time, the insurance company, the carrier, has no further responsibility to the insurer beyond the cost of things. I think the whole basis of the Stowers Doctrine is to protect the insurer against the risk, the harm, the damage of an excess judgment, as this court's written many times and fairly recently. The harm is in having execution issued, having the sheriff come out and levy, having someone take your property, garnish your bank accounts. But once that harm or that potential harm is eliminated, it seems to me that then the insurance company is limited by its contract.
Then excuse me, but I come back to my question, somewhat modified, and Judge Corn's question. Then can this kind of cause of action ever be assigned in your...
Yes, certainly.
If there's a full... Once there's an assignment...
Once there's an assignment...
Then the insured is protected.
But so. the carrier is still liable to the extent of its policy.
Well, I understand that, but... The carrier is only liable because of some of damages that have already been filed in the underlying cause if they come up, if they exceed those policy limits, meet or exceed.
Well, once the insured assigns his claims and has no liability for further claims in excess of policy limits, then it would seem to me that the whole policy, the whole purpose of the Stowers Doctrine has been fulfilled.
How does the bad faith tort and our language in Vail interact with the Stowers Doctrine?
That's right, Your Honor, because the insurer's not hurt.
Well, all it seems to make my question clear. The bad faith doctrine, as enunciated in Arnold and Aranda, contemplates more than just an insured being able to recover up to the amount of policy limits because of certain injuries that the insured may suffer, and you seemingly recognize those because of
correct.
The insurance company's conduct. The Vail case contemplated that could frequently be mandatorily trebled.
Once you have the assignment prior to trial of the liability case, then the insured is not at risk. The insured cannot suffer any harm, injury, or damage.
But that's true of any assignment. Once there's an assignment of a cause of action.
Prior to trial, that's correct. And I think the court has to look at what is the responsibility of the insurance company. If they issue a policy that provides coverage of $100,000, what the company agrees to do is provide that coverage. What the insurer gets with his coverage is to be protected up to the extent of the policy limits.
They also contract to provide defense.
That's correct. And this case is fully defended. That issue has been raised all the way through, and it's a red herring, Your Honor.
But the insurance company can commit a tort in the course of performing or failing to perform on that contract.
That's correct.
And my question is, how does the possibility of that tort interplay in with the Stowers Doctrine, which arises only really in a contractual setting?
I think once the insured is fully protected, as here, there are no additional damages.
So an insurance company can do anything it wants to in the face of a covenant not to execute except on any recoverable insurance and with impunity. Would that be the result of the scenario you just proposed? As long as there's no chance that the insured will suffer an excess judgment, the insurance company can do anything they want.
That's right. Let me give the example that I use counseling my clients. You have a case where you've got $1 million coverage. That's the limits of the policy. And a plaintiff's lawyer, like Mr. Crisp, makes a demand for $1 million. The insurance company committed to the defense of the case doesn't think it's worth it. And so they decline to settle the case with $1 million policy limits. Now, what I would tell my insurance company is, guys, if you're not going to do it within the policy limits, you have bought the point. You owe whatever the verdict is. And it may be $1 million, it may be $2 million, it may be $3 million. But having declined to protect the insurer within the policy limits, you're going to have to pay whatever the verdict is. Now, at that point in time, Your Honor, that's the decision for the insurance company to make. And the insurer, as Dr. Garcia was here, is fully protected. It shouldn't matter to the insurer one way or the other. And that is the context of this case. Dr. Garcia didn't get hurt. Mr. Cardenas got hurt, and he got his money back and more. And that's what this case, it seems to me, is all about, is everybody who got hurt got paid more than full.
Any other questions at this time? I was just asking the court if there were any other questions, and there do not appear to be. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Very well. May it please the court.
May it please the court. Mr. Ronald Crisp will present argument for respondent.
The problem with the argument proposed by counsel has to do with confusion between the underlying judgment and settlements relative to the underlying judgments as opposed to settlement monies that would be applicable to the 21-21 judgment. Surely, we are not at a point whereby the payment of an underlying judgment of 21-21 has been repealed, which would be the situation if you follow Mr. Bishop's idea to its conclusion. Before we get into, however, the substance of that, let's review factually what happened in this case, because it is not the type of case that courts fear and should fear with reference to collusion and fraud. This was a lawsuit that was filed and defended not by APIE, but by ICA, the settling defendant. There is a letter in the statement of facts that indicates that APIE withdrew their coverage and their defense shortly before the trial of this case. There was a jury issue asking whether or not APIE abandoned the plaintiff and failed to defend, and it was answered affirmatively that they did not defend Dr. Garcia in this case.
That was in the subsequent case.
That was in the second case, yes. That they did not defend Dr. Garcia in the underlying case. The question was asked, of course, in the second case, whether or not he was defended in the underlying case, and the jury said he was not defended by APIE, that they were guilty of bad faith. 35 consecutive issues. Now, in context again, this lawsuit was represented to have a coverage of $600,000. Plaintiff's counsel offered to take it. Subsequently, they say we're wrong. We have $1.1 million coverage. Plaintiff's counsel agreed to take it, or offered to take it. It was rejected. Subsequently, they said, no, we found more coverage. There's $1.6 million. Plaintiff's counsel offered to take it. It was not paid. Now, a matter of a few days, if not a mere matter of hours before the trial, after 18 months of representing to Dr. Garcia that he was protected by APIE in writing and oral, and it's fully developed in the record in this case, they contact Dr. Garcia, and according to Ross Crossland, the lawyer who was representing Dr. Garcia, he says, I have a bombshell. They have withdrawn coverage and left Dr. Garcia without the protection of APIE, whereupon he undertook, with the assistance of his insurance company paid for counsel, Ross Crossland, paid for by ICA, and Clem Lyons, his individual lawyer, to fashion an agreement that would protect his estate less exposed by APIE's conduct. And what was that? That was a covenant not to execute in exchange for an assignment of his cause of action. Now, that is a valuable asset, that cause of action against APIE, the recalcitrant carrier. He should not have the transferability of that alienated by any public policy of this or any other state. He should be able to take that one bargaining chip he has, and in exchange for that bargaining chip, to wit, his cause of action against the carrier, secure from the plaintiff a covenant not to execute against his individual state. Now, what does that do? When you distill it down, crystallize it down to its basic bare bones, it simply transfers the coverage risk from the assured doctor to the plaintiff. Let's assume that this was a policy defended because that API said, hey, you hadn't paid your premiums. All right, who assumes the risk of that no coverage under an assignment and a covenant? The doctor assigns his cause of action in exchange for a covenant, which YMCA says does not blot out the judgment. The doctor then, after having assigned the case, is free. The plaintiff has an intelligent decision to make whether or not he wants to accept that assignment in lieu of any remedies against the doctor. And he accepts that risk, and if he goes and prosecutes APIE, as was done in this case, and it is determined that the doctor had not paid his premiums and clearly there was no coverage, who suffers that loss? The plaintiff, not the doctor. Now, why should we fashion a rule in this state that would require doctors to not protect themselves by such covenants, but that would require doctors to take the full brunt of these judgments and not allow them the flexibility to deflect this responsibility to the plaintiff? It makes no sense to say, doctors, you're paralyzed from using this one bargaining chip. You're paralyzed from transferring this asset. And of course, if you say the covenant's not to execute, result in no damage to the doctor, and thus the incentive to the plaintiff is totally gone. No plaintiff is going to accept an assignment if it's unenforceable. So there'd be no incentive for the plaintiff at all to do that.
Were the Cardenases made whole in a legal sense when they received the $2.5 million paid by ICA and APA?
No, Judge, not even close. And here's why.
Well, let me just frame it for you a little, so we can get to my question. The Judge Chapa tried the case in an adversarial proceeding, where the record shows, and determined the damages to be less than that.
That's correct.
And so. Could you explain to me how it is that the $2.5 million paid by ICA and API did not satisfy that legal injury?
I certainly will, Judge. And that is, when Judge Chapa took his pen and affixed it to his signature to that judgment, that matured the cause of action under 2121. That matured the bad faith cause of action. That matured the Stowers cause of action. That matured the punitive damage cause of action. And you cannot absolve yourself of this new cause of action that is owned by Dr. Garcia by satisfying belatedly the underlying judgment.
You have to have actual damages to be entitled to exemplary or multiple damages. And can you explain to me what the actual damages were?
The actual damages was the judgment against Dr. Garcia.
But it was paid.
Well, it was paid, but it was paid after the cause of action for 2121 matured.
You can't hardly pay it before. I mean, if you pay the judgment, then
Judge, if
Dr. Garcia came in, if he didn't assign it, if he just went to trial, and he got a judgment against him for $2.3 million, and the insurance company paid it.
If that were the case,
can he still bring a Stowers action for punitive damage?
Oh, he sure can. Clearly he can, because you don't repeal 2121 by a tardy tender of limits. I mean,
the question was Stowers, and then your answer is 2121. That's very confusing area. But
you're limiting that inquiry to Stowers.
Well, one after the other.
Stowers wants the judgment has been satisfied, I think, under the Stowers doctrine, without any punitive or bad faith damages involved. I think it's resolved.
But there could be still a claim for punitive damage.
Yes, that's exactly
even
correct.
If there were no actual, because it had been paid.
That's absolutely correct. I'm simply saying you don't repeal 2121, and the punitive aspects of that, as is pointed out in this court's opinion in Stewart versus Sterling, the 2121 carries with it certain punitive aspects, and you cannot be absolved of past sins, if you will, in the underlying case by tardily and belatedly and untimely saying, well, we now recognize our fault and we'll now pay. It's too late to pay, because when you left the doctor isolated and uninsured and undefended, and there are jury findings to that effect. It's not my saying one thing and Mr. Bishop saying another. The jury found he was not defended by EPI. Once you do that, once you allow judgment to be entered, and then some years later you say, well, I want to pay off that judgment, that doesn't absolve it of the multiplying effect that has attended their conduct.
You're saying the petitioner's trying to compare apples with oranges.
I am. Justice Cook, that's precisely what I'm saying. They continue to confuse the settlement funds paid in the APIE 2121 cause of action, and they keep trying to apply that against the underlying judgment. And that case is over. That case is the genesis of this case, but you can't, I mean, why else have triple damages? I mean, if any time you can go in and pay the basic damages and avoid the punitive aspects of 2121, every carrier would just sit back and wait, and whatever they say, well, we don't have to worry about the ramifications of 2121, we'll pay the underlying judgment off and we're absolved. That's not the law. Clearly, the Williams case and many others in this and other jurisdictions say that once you have committed that sin, it stays with you and cannot be absolved by simply paying the underlying judgment.
Do you agree that there is no claim of actual damages other than the judgment? That's the only claim in this case.
That is correct.
Mr. Bishop says there might be a claim in another case, but there isn't one in this case.
That is correct. I think the damages to Dr. Garcia, the actual damages, are composed of the $2.25 million judgment that was rendered in Cardenas versus Garcia that was multiplied by the application of 2121 and the jury findings 35 in number supporting that claim, which encompassed every conceivable violation of 2121 known to the law. And the jury answered every one of them, plus attorney's fees, found that they did everything that was alleged.
Mr. Chris, can you contrast the facts in this case with a situation where no insurance company defended the defendant, and the defendant essentially reached a deal with the plaintiff prior to the first trial?
I sure can.
There's a non-jury trial, and both sides are urging the judge to award as high an amount of damages as possible, and a number is then awarded, which becomes fixed damages for a subsequent case.
I think that there should not be any rule of law that ever prevents an insurance carrier to the ability to look beyond the judgment and determine whether or not this judgment was brought about as a result of collusion, and determine whether or not this judgment was brought about by a fraud. The open-ended situation where you have a cozy deal, if you will, where the insurance lawyer is not involved, where plaintiff's counsel and the insurance counsel get down and they sit down and they fraudulently or collude and come up with a figure of damages, and then they go sue the insurance company and say, you're prevented, Mr. Carrier, from looking beyond this deal. That's nonsense. It's bad. We don't stand for that. We don't believe in that. We think that the court ought to pass a rule that says you can look beyond that.
Now, if we were to do that, why would an insurance company ever provide a defense under a reservation of rights? If we were to make this the distinction I think you're just drawing, which has some appeal to it, if the insurance company provides an attorney under a reservation of rights, then they're essentially bound by whatever happens. But if they just let the plaintiff and the defendant go off on their own, then they can always attack the entire amount in a subsequent case.
They can't attack it, and I mean, you know, even if the insurance company offers a defense.
Well, what's the intent? If we adopted the rule that you just announced, if we were to come to that, either in this case or in a series of cases, what's the incentive for the insurance company to provide a defense? That's my question.
Well, if it's a defensible lawsuit, they don't ever get the basic judgment. That's the answer. If it's a defensible lawsuit, the measure of damages are zero if it's totally defensible, and if it's not, at least you know that you're going to have an adversary proceeding and the amount of damages has been set by a judicial proceeding and not by an agreement that may or may not have any relationship to fact. I think that in this case, incidentally, this is not a good case to test that doctrine, because not only do we have Judge Chapa, not a runaway jury verdict, there's never even been any contest that it was a reasonable and fair result in this tardive dyskinesia was the ailment that this man suffered at the hands of Dr. Garcia.
Well, there was an appeal, wasn't there, that was dismissed because Dr. Garcia disagreed that the insurance company would be able to appeal the case since they didn't defend him.
That's correct. Once the law, of course, clearly is, once you wrongly refuse to defend, you can't rejuvenate that right. You have lost it irretrievably forever. And ICA dismissed the appeal. Let me tell you how that came about, if I might, Judge. This $500,000 that was paid for a continuance, while the case was continued, and I think the record will show, in order to give APIE time to sue Bailey and Williams, the lawyers that were involved in monitoring this case for APIE at the trial level in the first case, they did in fact sue Bailey and Williams. Bailey and Williams received a directed verdict at the end of the case. But Bailey and Williams, when we first filed Garcia versus APIE, filed an answer for APIE. Then Bailey and Williams attempted to appear in the Court of Civil Appeals in San Antonio and say, we're representing Dr. Garcia. They were in the lower court, they were opposed to him, and in the appellate court, they said, we're on your side. Dr. Garcia said, no, you're not. You're the same law firm that answered my lawsuit against APIE, and now you're coming in and telling me you're going to defend me in the same lawsuit? I'm not going to go for it. But in this case, not only did we have a judgment by Judge Chapa, but additionally, we even asked an issue to the jury, what was the reasonable damages, which was unnecessary because in Allstate versus Kelly, damages are set by the underlying judgment. But not to take any chances, we asked the jury an issue. In other words, the reasonableness of Judge Chapa's judgment. And they found it to be exactly what his judgment was. And we asked the jury another question. Was any part of this, even though it was a judgment and not an agreement, collusive? They answered it was not. So we had, in addition, we've gone beyond what the law requires and got jury findings that this was not a fraudulent collusive situation. And on page 7 of appellant's application for writ of error, page 7, they set forth the fact that he was adequately defended by Ross Crossland, and there's no suggestion that this doctor didn't get his day in court. That's not a collusive case. This is not that. So the whole question is there anything about, and Judge, the truth of it is, let's cut to the chase. There is case law in the form of YMCA that says covenants not to execute, do not blot out the judgment, do not make them go away, and they're assignable, and they're still only, the execution is only stayed off by the contract, which is breachable. And then there's other cases that I'm certain that can be found in other jurisdictions to say there's no damage and you have a covenant not to execute. And so we need to just determine which of those two bodies we're going to adopt. And what is so villainous about covenants not to execute? Once again, all they do is transfer the risk of no coverage from the doctor to the plaintiff. And if the doctor actually has no coverage, but he has got a covenant not to execute against him in consideration for him assigning that valueless cause of action, so be it. In this instance, for example, Dr. Garcia would have had to live with this judgment against him for 5 years, and he would be paralyzed by the rule that is suggested by appellant. He'd be paralyzed from bargaining with the plaintiff and saying, take this cause of action against the carrier and leave me alone. He'd be powerless to do that because the appellate would have this court say that covenants not to execute are sinister, and they blot out the judgment, and the doctor hadn't been damaged, and thus there is nothing to assign. If that's the case, If covenants to execute are against public policy and thus not enforceable, or fail because they blot out the judgment, then the plaintiff has received nothing in consideration of his covenant not to execute. He's received nothing. And if he's received nothing, that contract is a nullity. It fails for lack of consideration, or it is a nullity because it's against public policy. And if it's a nullity, then he is not saved from levying execution on Dr. Garcia.
Would this be a different case if the amount of money that Mr. Cardenas and his family had received had been, say, $500,000, and Judge Chapa found the injuries to Mr. Cardenas, the legal value, so to speak, worth $2.25 million? I mean, there'd be a that'd be a different case.
You mean this a typical Stowers case, Your Honor?
Well, I'm talking about where the amounts paid in settlement were less than the amount found by the trier of fact to be the damages.
No, I don't think so at all. Once again, we have to segregate, and we can't confuse the settlement dollars paid in the 2121 case with the settlement dollars that were never paid. There's never been any settlement dollars paid in the underlying case, ever. There's never been a release of the underlying judgment. ICA paid $2 million, which was $900,000 above their limits, and there was nothing except a release of ICA. Which brings me to another point that I think the court should be aware of, and that's reconciling Traders and General versus Hicks with Stewart versus Sterling. And it is my opinion that those are reconcilable opinions. If someone wants to ask me a question about how I reconcile them, I'll answer it.
How are they reconciled?
All right. Traders and General versus Hicks, says that in determining contractual liability, not extra-contractual 2121 liability, but contractual liability, that the obligations of the carriers are several. So in this instance, it would be several. But when calculating 2121 damages, and according with the Stewart opinion, the Baylor versus Bradshaw comes into play, and although in Baylor versus in Sterling, there was not a finding of joint tortfeasors. There is in this case, and there was just a mention in footnote 10 that Baylor versus Bradshaw was applied, and the old 2212 was not applied because there wasn't a finding of joint liability. There is a finding of joint liability here, and Baylor versus Bradshaw surely applies because of the Sterling versus Sterling opinion, and perhaps, since there's a finding of joint liability, the pro rata Palestine contractors in 2212 might apply. That's for the court to decide. But that's just on the extra contractual damages. On the contractual damages, Traders in General still apply. The carriers, joint carriers, liability context, have several responsibilities, which is relevant only to this extent. When calculating the damages to be trebled, the Court of Civil Appeals took both coverages combined of $1,600,000 and said the damages awarded in the court below in excess of the combined coverages under Allstate versus Kelly is what should be tripled. That's not so. Traders in General would say that you triple the amount of damages in excess of the APIE coverage alone of $500,000 because it's several, and you do not have the benefit of ICA's coverage, since it is a several and not a joint and several responsibility when you have co-insurance on the same loss.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, I've got more to say than I can say in the time I have left. The first obvious thing is that Mr. Crisp's position is that because somebody did something wrong, we can't be absolved. We owe triple damages, attorney's fees, and everything forever. But he also said, and I think it was quite clear in response to a question, the damages suffered here were the amount of the judgment. And those have been paid. There is no question about it. So what he is saying is that the sin of something he says we did wrong lingers forever. So until we pay the damages and triple the damages and pay attorney's fees forever. And I still suggest to the court, as I have in my brief, if there's no harm, there's no foul. The damages have been paid. They've been more than paid. And there is, and was not, at the time this case went to trial, a lawsuit for damages.
In Stewart against Sterling, our recent opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
We applied the Bradshaw one recovery rule and said that they were entitled to a credit of the amount that was paid. But it was post-trebling. It was after the addition of the statutory damages in that case. Why shouldn't that be the rule in this case?
Well, in Stewart, there were damages applying either way.
There were damages after the incident occurred. There was a amount paid in settlement of those damages.
That's correct.
The amount, as it turned out, equaled what the jury found. And then, nevertheless, there were, of course, statutory damages added
correct.
To that. Why isn't that the case here? There's a judgment, there are damages, there's an amount paid. You're entitled to a credit, but it's against the statutorily enhanced damages.
Well, the reason here is that there was the over and under agreement, where the amount of the damages my client could suffer at most was $2 million.
Did that include statutory damages?
It included all the damages. That was the limit of liability on the part of my client. So what you have here is you've got a...
You're talking about the malpractice case, counsel?
No. This was the partial settlement agreement.
Okay.
And what you have here is $2 million credit from the ICA payment under Stewart title. You've got the $2 million cap that we paid and contracted for when we paid $500,000. So the most you're going to get is zero.
And you're saying that that written agreement on the over-under expressly included these claims that might be brought in a subsequent bad faith type of suit, whether by the doctor or his assignee?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. That was the context of the agreement. I mean, the bad faith case was set for trial at the time of the agreement. It was not an afterthought.
Mr. Crist argues that if the ordinary penalties of punitive damages and statutory damages are not added to any actual damages suffered by a judgment of this kind being taken, then the insurance company has no incentive not to abandon ship before the trial, since its damages are going to be whatever they are. What's the response to that?
The insurance company has every incentive and the obligation to fully defend the case. And look in the context of this case, if you would, Your Honor. The Dr. Garcia saw the patient once during the period of coverage by my client. The jury found, in this case, that my client had 16% of the obligation. That amounts to roughly $257,000. And yet now, if Mr. Crist were to persuade this court somehow, my client would be liable for $9 million, having already paid $500,000.
Let me rephrase it a little differently. If an insurer decides not to defend a case for whatever reason, and a judgment is rendered in excess of the policy limits, and the insurer refuses to pay, and a Stiers claim is brought by the insurer, we'll keep it simple, it's brought by the insurer, the insured is entitled to receive the full amount of that judgment and the punitive damages if he can prove gross negligence and cost. Is that true?
And tell about the insurer.
He may have some statutory claims as well.
I don't have any problem, and I know that we were arguing crossways, Mr. Christian.
So is that...
The insured has an absolute right, in my judgment, to assign to the plaintiff his claims under the policy. What I'm saying is that does not give rise in and of itself to liability above and beyond the policy limits.
Why not? It would ordinarily give rise to liability in an ordinary Stowers claim, right?
No.
No punitive damage.
The Stowers claim arises from an independent set of facts.
If the insured suffers a judgment because, and the insurer has not defended, the insured may have statutory and Stowers claims.
That's correct.
Regardless of whether that judgment is paid.
I think that's correct.
What difference does it make if it's assigned?
If it's assigned?
Yes, sir.
It doesn't make any difference.
Well, why is that different from this case?
Well, the claim against the insured is whatever damage the insured suffers by reason of the judgment. Under the assignment in this case, beyond any question, Dr. Garcia suffered no damage by reason of the judgment in the malpractice case. None. He was no more harmed than you were, I was, Mr. Chris was, or Judge Gavitch was. So there were no claims that arose by reason of that assignment. Now, the idea that, and you know, I think I've been kind of mistreated by Mr. Chris, which is often the case. I am not opposed, and I don't see any problem with the assignment of the policy rights. But you have to have damage. Someone has to get hurt. And it may be, in one case, it may be the amount of judgment. I think Allstate against Kelly is too arbitrary because I don't think that's necessarily measured damage. In some cases, it may be much more. In some cases, it may be nothing. I mean, you can envision, if you would, a guy who sells firewood with no assets in a rented house and suffers $1 million judgment against him and goes down and looks in the phone book and hires a lawyer and files a Chapter 7, he probably has suffered very little damage. But here, there was no damage. No damage, no lawsuit. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in the first part. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.